In our previous lecture, we looked at the transition in the Supreme Court from the leadership of Chief Justice John Marshall to his successor, Roger Brooke Taney. Marshall's death in 1835, after 34 years as Chief Justice, removed from the court a forceful advocate of political and judicial nationalism. Marshall had shaped the court from an ineffective body into an institution that wielded power over the other branches of the federal government and the states, and that commanded respect as an institution even from those who disagreed with its rulings. In contrast, Chief Justice Taney came to the bench in 1836 as a firm advocate of states' rights and as a passionate defender of slavery. We looked in the previous lecture at both Marshall's and Taney's approach to the divisive issue of slavery. Marshall expressed his moral objection to slavery, while Taney had no such qualms. But we also saw, through cases that involved the kidnapping of black persons who sought their freedom, how both men accepted the lawfulness of slavery. We're going to devote this lecture to another case of a black person who sought his freedom from slavery, a man named Dred Scott. The court's decision in 1857, in the case of Dred Scott versus John Sanford, has gained notoriety as the most shameful ruling in the court's history. Chief Justice Taney's opinion in the Dred Scott case was immediately attacked by opponents of slavery as a perversion of the Constitution, and the court's ruling poured oil on the flames of national discord that soon erupted into a bloody civil war. Our purpose in this lecture is not simply to recount the facts of the Dred Scott case, nor to analyze Chief Justice Taney's opinion as a judicial act, although we'll do both of those things. Rather, we'll look at this landmark case from the perspective of two men, two fellow human beings. Dred Scott had a single and simple goal in filing a lawsuit in 1846. He sought freedom for himself and his family from the degradation of slavery. Chief Justice Taney also had a single and simple goal in deciding that lawsuit. He sought to keep every member of what he had earlier called the degraded class of black Americans from gaining their freedom. Both of these men were born in the United States, and both had two daughters. We can assume that both men loved and cherished their children and worked hard to provide the best life they could for them. But one of these two men, in my view, was infected with a disease, the crippling disease of racism. Dred Scott would most likely have acknowledged the humanity of the man whose decision kept him in slavery. But Chief Justice Taney could only look at Dred Scott as an article of merchandise, as his opinion described slaves. It simply will not do, I think, to view Taney as the product of his times, a time in which slavery was considered by many white people to be supported by the Constitution and even supported by the Bible as God's will. But there were many whites of Taney's class and background who considered slavery to violate a higher law than the Constitution and to violate every precept of Christianity. Men like John Quincy Adams and William Sumner, who were both eminent lawyers and members of Congress, fought against slavery as passionately as Taney defended it. As we look at the Dred Scott case, it's important to keep in mind that Taney's opinion did not reflect, as he claimed, the fixed and universal views of the white race. What it reflected, in my opinion, were the views of those whites like Taney whose vision was distorted and warped by racism. Any other view of his opinion, I think, runs the danger of excusing, or at least minimizing, the crippling effects of Taney's disease. Now, I've made these comments as a preface to this lecture, rather than adding them at its conclusion, because I think we need to look at the Dred Scott case in its broader context, as a dramatic and tragic episode in the conflict over race that has divided both the Supreme Court and American society for more than two centuries. With that preface, let's begin with Dred Scott himself. Who was Dred Scott? I pose this question because the answer shows us that no one knows for sure when or where he was born, or even what his real name was. This fact tells us a great deal about an institution that robbed its victims, not only of their rights, but often of their names. We do know that he was born sometime around 1800, perhaps in Virginia, and may have been known simply as Sam, before his owner, a man named Peter Blow, moved from Alabama to St. Louis, Missouri in 1830. After Blow's death in 1832, his executor sold two of his six slaves to Dr. John Emerson, one named Sam and the other with no recorded name. One of these two slaves may have been known as Dred Scott, or Dr. Emerson may have given him this name. By all accounts, Emerson was a poor physician and a chronic malcontent. He finagled a position as an Army medical officer and was posted to Fort Armstrong in Illinois, where he was accompanied by Dred Scott as a servant. It's important to note that Illinois was a free state in which slavery was prohibited by state law. Now, Dr. Emerson quarreled with his commanding officers and asked to return to St. Louis. 2 years later, he was posted to Fort Snelling in what was then called Wisconsin Territory and is now part of Minnesota. This was also free territory in which slavery had been banned by Congress under the Northwest Ordinance of 1787. While he lived at Fort Snelling, Dred Scott married a young slave girl named Harriet Robinson, and they had two daughters, Eliza and Lizzie, who were both born in free territory. Dr. Emerson again quarreled with his commanders and was later posted to Louisiana and Florida. The Army finally had enough of Emerson, and he was dismissed from service in 1842. He returned to St. Louis and died, most likely from syphilis, in 1843. The next chapter in Dred Scott's story began in 1846, when he filed a lawsuit in a Missouri state court seeking freedom for himself and his family. The record is unclear, but it's most likely that his former owners, the Blow family, hired a lawyer for the Scotts. The Blows had remained close to their former slave and supported his suit for freedom. The legal complaint alleged that Dred Scott was a free person by virtue of his residence in both Illinois and Wisconsin territory. Suits for freedom were not uncommon in Missouri, and the state's highest court had repeatedly held that masters who took their slaves into free territory had emancipated them. More importantly, the Missouri courts also held that slavery did not reattach when emancipated slaves returned to that state. The legal doctrine of that time was once free, always free. And in fact, after much delay and two separate trials, a jury ruled in 1850 that Dred Scott and his family were free persons and no longer slaves. But the next chapter in this story took another turn. Mrs. Emerson filed an appeal from the jury verdict with the Missouri Supreme Court, which decided the case in 1852. Unfortunately for the Scotts, Missouri's judges were elected by the voters, who had placed two new justices on the court, both of them pro-slavery Democrats. The state judges reversed the jury verdict, ruling that they were bound by an 1851 decision of the United States Supreme Court in a case called Strader versus Graham. This case began when two slaves who entertained white audiences as minstrels were sent by their owner from the slave state of Kentucky to the free state of Ohio. And they kept on going to freedom in Canada. Their owner brought a suit for damages against several whites in Ohio who helped the slaves escape to freedom. Chief Justice Taney wrote for the Supreme Court in the Strader case, ruling that the status of slaves in Kentucky, in his words, depended altogether upon the laws of that state and could not be influenced by the laws of Ohio. In other words, Taney rejected the doctrine of once free, always free. The new doctrine was now once a slave, always a slave. The Missouri judges eagerly adopted Taney's ruling and returned Dred Scott and his family to Mrs. Emerson as slaves. But the Scotts did not give up after their freedom was snatched away by the state judges. Supported by the Blow family, they filed a new lawsuit, this time in the federal court in St. Louis. And the defendants in this suit included Mrs. Emerson's brother, John Sanford, who had claimed joint ownership of the Scotts with his sister in the state courts. It's important to note that John Sanford was supposedly a resident and citizen of New York State. The record is unclear that Sanford actually resided in New York, and it's likely that the lawyers on both sides agreed to name him as a defendant to bring the case into federal court. Now, Article 3 of the Constitution gives the Supreme Court jurisdiction over suits between citizens of different states, even if the suits are based on state law. And this jurisdiction extends to the district courts as well. What we call the Diversity Clause of the Constitution became a crucial issue in the Dred Scott case when it reached the Supreme Court, as we'll see. The federal judge who presided at the trial in 1854 ruled that he was bound by the Supreme Court's decision in the Strader case, and he instructed the jury to return a verdict for John Sanford and his sister. But the judge did not decide the question of whether Dred Scott was a citizen of Missouri with the right to bring a suit in federal court. He merely ruled that Scott was a resident of Missouri and allowed the case to go before the jury. And it's also important to note that Sanford's lawyers did not contest the judge's ruling on this issue. The question of whether Dred Scott was in fact a citizen of Missouri with a right to bring his suit in federal court was the crucial issue in the case when it reached the Supreme Court. The next chapter in this story began in December of 1854, when Dred Scott's lawyers filed an appeal with the Supreme Court. They had little money and little chance of success in the case. What they needed was a lawyer of national renown and with experience before the court. John Sanford had already hired a former United States Attorney General and United States Senator, Reverdy Johnson of Maryland. Johnson was an old friend of Chief Justice Taney and a formidable lawyer. The Scott family's lawyers circulated a pamphlet that Dred had supposedly written, although he was probably illiterate. But it spoke volumes about his plight. "I have no money to pay anybody at Washington to speak for me," the pamphlet said. "My fellow men, can any of you help me in my day of trial? Will nobody speak for me at Washington, even without hope of other reward than the blessings of a poor black man and his family?" On Christmas Eve of 1854, Scott's appeal reached Montgomery Blair, a prominent lawyer who had moved from St. Louis to establish a practice before the Supreme Court. Blair gave Dred Scott the Christmas present of his services without a fee. The Supreme Court did not hear arguments in Dred Scott's case until February of 1856. Because the court's rules then required the justices to hear appeals in any case from lower federal courts, its docket was crowded and cases moved slowly. Dred Scott's fate rested in the hands of justices who reflected the appointments of six presidents, from Andrew Jackson in 1829 to Franklin Pierce in 1853. And it's significant that five of the justices who heard the arguments were Southerners. Chief Justice Taney was flanked on the court's bench by Justices James Wayne of Georgia, John Catron of Tennessee, Peter Daniel of Virginia, and John Campbell of Alabama. All of these justices owned slaves or came from slave-owning families. It's also significant that the four northern justices on the court included two, Samuel Nelson of New York and Robert Greer of Pennsylvania, who were Democrats and who sided with their party's pro-slavery wing. Only John McLean of Ohio and Benjamin Curtis of Massachusetts had no ties to the Democrats, although both men had supported the constitutionality of the Fugitive Slave Act. So Montgomery Blair faced a daunting task when he began his argument for Dred Scott. Blair rested his argument on the claim that Scott had been emancipated by his residence in Illinois as a servant to Dr. Emerson. But this was a slim read, given Chief Justice Taney's ruling in the Strader case that slaves who returned to states where slavery was legal were not emancipated by residents in free states. As we saw, Taney had replaced the doctrine of once free, always free with the doctrine of once a slave, always a slave. In their answer to Blair's argument, John Sanford's lawyers made two points. They first claimed that Dred Scott had no standing to bring a suit in federal court because a slave was not a citizen of any state. Now, this argument, of course, begged the question, because the central issue before the justices was whether Dred Scott was a citizen of Missouri. If he was, then he had standing under the diversity clause of the Constitution to sue John Sanford in federal court. But if the court ruled that Scott was not a citizen, then his suit would be dismissed. Sanford's lawyers also launched an attack on the constitutionality of the Missouri Compromise of 1820. This was an issue that none of the lawyers had raised in the lower courts, and it requires some background and explanation. The Missouri Compromise began in 1819, when white residents of that territory asked Congress to grant their petition for statehood. They had drafted a constitution that made slavery lawful, but the abolitionist bloc in Congress objected to any further expansion of slavery into the Western territories. The opponents and defenders of slavery were almost equally balanced in Congress at that time. So the House Speaker, Henry Clay of Kentucky, worked out a deal that satisfied both sides. Residents of Maine, which was then part of Massachusetts, had also petitioned Congress for statehood with a constitution that banned slavery. The compromise that Clay fashioned would admit both states to the Union with a provision that slavery would be banned in any territory north of the southern border of Missouri. In other words, Missouri would become the last state in the northern half of the nation in which slavery would be lawful. John Sanford's lawyers asked the justices to hold that Congress lacked the power to enact the Missouri Compromise. Now, why did they raise this issue for the first time in the Supreme Court? They actually had two goals in mind. First, they wanted to close the door on the claim that Dred Scott's residence in Wisconsin territory had emancipated him, although Montgomery Blair had not pressed this argument to the court. But Sanford's lawyers had a more ambitious goal in attacking the Missouri Compromise. They hoped to enlist the Supreme Court in the campaign to nationalize slavery. In other words, a ruling that the Missouri Compromise was unconstitutional would allow pro-slavery whites in northern and western territories to gain statehood with constitutions that gave them the right to own slaves. This issue had already become a flashpoint in political battles between northern abolitionists and southern defenders of slavery. So what seemed like legal jousting in the Dred Scott case had much greater potential significance than the fate of a poor black man and his family. Now, after the arguments concluded in February of 1856, the justices met several times to discuss the case, and they decided to schedule another round of arguments in December, some 10 months later. The court did not explain its reasons for putting off its decision. The most likely reason is that the justices were hesitant to rule on the politically charged issue of slavery just before the nation became embroiled in a divisive presidential campaign. And that campaign, with three major candidates, did not become the national referendum on slavery that a ruling in the Dred Scott case might have been provoked. But the outcome of the election must have pleased Chief Justice Taney. When the ballots were counted, a minority of the nation's voters had placed James Buchanan of Pennsylvania in the White House. Buchanan was a Democrat who straddled the fence on the slavery issue, but he owed his victory to the pro-slavery faction in his party. After the election, the second round of arguments in the Dred Scott case began on December 15th of 1856. Montgomery Blair repeated his claim that Scott's residence in Illinois had emancipated him and that he was a citizen of Missouri, withstanding to file his suit for freedom in federal court. John Sanford's lawyers were confident the court would reject this claim, and they directed their fire at the Missouri Compromise. They argued for a narrow construction of the provision in Article 4 of the Constitution, which states that Congress shall have power to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory of the United States. Sanford's lawyers argued that this clause simply allowed Congress to establish rules for governing the territories, such as the structure of territorial legislatures. Prohibiting slavery, they said, was not the kind of needful legislation required to govern a territory. Now, this was a very debatable claim, to say the least. In fact, Chief Justice John Marshall had written an opinion in 1828 that rejected the narrow reading of Article 4. Ruling in a case that dealt with the territory of Florida, Marshall said this about the territories: in legislating for them, Congress exercises the combined powers of the general and of a state government. States clearly have the power to prohibit slavery within their borders, and Marshall extended that power to Congress. But John Sanford's lawyers had a receptive audience in Chief Justice Taney and his Southern colleagues, and Marshall's ruling did not faze them. On March 6th of 1857, the justices gathered to announce the court's decision in the Dred Scott case. Each of the nine justices wrote something to explain his position in the case, ranging from a few paragraphs to 55 pages of small print in the official reports. They split into several factions on the issues raised in the case, but the bottom line, decided by a vote of 7-2, was that Dred Scott was still a slave. All the attention focused on Chief Justice Taney, who read from his lengthy opinion for more than 2 hours, speaking in a low voice in the crowded chamber. We're going to focus on Taney's opinion because he spoke for the court on the two crucial issues in the case and because his words framed the political debate that followed the court's ruling. Taney posed the central issue of Dred Scott's citizenship in these words: "The question is simply this: can a Negro whose ancestors were imported into this country and sold as slaves become a member of the political community formed and brought into existence by the Constitution of the United States, and as such become entitled to all the rights and privileges and immunities guaranteed by that instrument to the citizen?" Taney's answer was no, but he devoted 24 pages of his opinion to a justification of this one-word conclusion. There are two reasons for the length of Taney's opinion on this issue. First, the real answer to the question was yes. Every state had free blacks in 1787, and the Constitution did not exclude them from citizenship. The framers distinguished between what they called free persons and all other persons, their euphemism for slaves. But if free blacks were considered citizens, then Dred Scott would have standing as a citizen to sue John Sanford if Scott's residence in Illinois or Wisconsin Territory had emancipated him. Now, these two questions are obviously related, and that relationship explains the second reason for Taney's lengthy discussion of black citizenship. The fact is that Taney was determined to rule that no black person, free or slave, could be a citizen. He reached this shocking conclusion by deliberately ignoring the evidence that free blacks were considered citizens by several states when the Constitution was adopted. To cover this huge gap in his argument, Taney looked outside the United States for support. He cited what he called the state of public opinion in England and Europe at the time the Constitution was adopted. And what did he find? He found that blacks were, in his words, regarded as beings of an inferior order and altogether unfit to associate with the white race, either in social or political relations, and so far inferior that they had no rights that the white man was bound to respect, and that the Negro might justly and lawfully be reduced to slavery for his own benefit. Taney depicted the treatment of blacks in cold, harsh words. He was bought and sold and treated as an ordinary article of merchandise and traffic whenever a profit could be made by it. Taney claimed, as he put it, that this opinion was fixed and universal in the civilized portion of the white race. As a matter of historical fact, this claim was false. Back in 1765, Sir William Blackstone published his Commentaries on the Laws of England, and the Supreme Court had often cited this influential treatise with respect. In Blackstone's words, a slave or Negro, the instant he lands in England, becomes a free man with all the rights of English citizenship. Long before the Dred Scott case was decided, Blackstone had refuted every claim Taney made about the legal status of blacks in England to justify his assertion that they were considered nothing more than property. Now, it's important to note that Taney was ruling that both free blacks and slaves were equally barred from citizenship. He stated firmly that free blacks were, in his words, regarded as a part of the slave population rather than the free. This was an audacious and totally false statement that ignored the historical evidence. Taney was, in effect, stripping free blacks of their citizenship. But this was necessary for his ruling, because it foreclosed the argument that Dred Scott had been emancipated by his residence on free soil. Under Taney's ruling, even if Scott had been emancipated, he still would lack standing to bring his suit for freedom in federal court. Now, if this all sounds complicated and convoluted, it is. But Taney was determined to make it impossible for any slave to challenge his or her captivity. With this ruling, Dred Scott's case was over and was dismissed by the court. It would seem that Taney had no further legal issues to decide, but the Chief Justice was equally determined to provide a legal basis for extending slavery into the vast territories that lay west of the Mississippi River. To accomplish this goal, he devoted another 22 pages of his opinion to the constitutionality of the Missouri Compromise. His argument on this issue was equally false and misleading. Taney first claimed that the Territories Clause in the Constitution referred solely to land already owned by the federal government in 1789. This was a groundless claim for which Taney produced no evidence. In fact, the framers had discussed the acquisition of new territories at length, and they had certainly intended that Congress could pass laws for their governance. Taney then argued that Congress had no power to ban slavery in the territories. As we saw, Chief Justice Marshall's opinion on this question in 1828 stood in Taney's path as precedent, but he simply walked around it, stating that Marshall was dealing, in that case, with congressional power to regulate territorial judicial systems. But this was an unconvincing distinction, since Marshall's words applied generally to congressional power over the territories. But Taney was determined to nationalize slavery, which he accomplished by holding the Missouri Compromise unconstitutional. We're ending this lecture with Chief Justice Taney's ruling in the Dred Scott case. As we've seen, his assertion that blacks were beings of an inferior order was a reflection of the racism at the core of his personal beliefs. And this racist attitude distorted and corrupted his judicial rulings that no black, free or slave, could be a citizen, and that Congress had no power to ban slavery in the territories. In the following lecture, we'll look at the heated political debate that followed the court's ruling and its impact on the growing national division over slavery. As we'll see, Taney's opinion provided ammunition for the partisans on both sides of a battle that soon erupted into the gunfire and bloodshed of the Civil War.